Hey, this is tennis legend Andy Roddick, and you're listening to What We're Drinking with Dan Dunn, a guy who's definitely been served more times than I have.
Well, pour yourself a glass, sit for a spill. It's time to have some fun. Let's do a little thinking, some picking and a drinking. Well, this is what we're drinking with Dan Dunn.
Welcome to What We're Drinking with Dan Dunn. I am Dan Dunn. Thanks for joining us today on the show. Got a big one coming up in just a little bit. My old friend, one of the world's most celebrated nature wildlife photographers from National Geographic. He's a director. He's got a new movie out called Into the Grand Canyon. Pete McBride's going to be joining us in just a little bit. I'm very excited to catch up with Pete, and I think you're going to love what this man has to say. He's just a fascinating individual. On the most recent episode, we had winemaker Trey Bush from Sleight of Hand Cellars in Walla Walla, Washington, joined us. And one of the things we're talking about was the actor Stephen Amell, who has he does a wine out of there called Knocking Point, where they contract various winemakers to make wines for them. So lo and behold, it's like we jinxed them or something. But right out, as soon as that episode aired, yesterday news broke, came across the transom that said that that Knocking Point recently received an FF, like as in fuck, from the Better Business Bureau after multiple complaints alleging that their orders were not delivered. People are not getting their orders from Knocking Point. I don't know what the hell's going on. According to the Better Business Bureau, they received 24 complaints over the past year and some bad customer reviews about Knocking Point wines. Consumers reported that they've been unable to get hold of the business to find out about the status of their orders, get refunds, cancel their accounts. The Bureau says these customers are reporting they're continuing to be charged subscription fees. And boy, I just don't know. So when I got this news, I was dismayed. I had Andrew Harding and Stephen Amell on my previous podcast. Seemed like really nice guys. They said running a good business. And as Trey Bush pointed out, they're one of the biggest wine clubs in the country right now. So Andrew Harding contacted Action News up there, up near Walla Walla, and he claimed that this situation was not accurate. It's KEPR-TV up there in Washington. Harding told them that they created new quarantine wine to raise money for COVID-19 response. They raised over $1 million for charity. He said he delivered this wine to over 50,000 customers. He is disappointed that the Better Business Bureau has decided to give Knocking Point an F rating after all the charitable work it has accomplished during the pandemic. And he also said he was never contacted by the Better Business Bureau. He released a statement saying, "We're very fortunate to have a Walla Walla-based winery with such a large customer base across the country." And then he went on to talk about the charity thing they did. And you jump ahead a little bit, and he said, "In the era of Amazon, customers begin to expect their orders from all retailers to show up almost instantly." And that's true. And there are a lot of challenges now getting things delivered. He said, "We knew we were facing an interrupted supply chain when we took on this giant project in April, and we proactively provided weekly shipping update emails and social media posts. While order delivery was delayed longer than, quote, normal turnaround times, we got every single order out the door and delivered to every customer who ordered this special wine." Okay. So here's my take on this. They're saying, what, 24 complaints, 50 out of 50,000? Come on, people. You get an F rating for that? You know, they had eight, he says, oh, here it is. He says, "We're fortunate to have nearly 100,000 direct-to-consumer wine orders placed on our website. We've had 18 Better Business Bureau complaints that result in an F rating. That's a 0.00018% of all customers complaining." And I gotta go with Andrew and Steven on this one. This seems like bullshit. Bullshit. I'm calling bullshit. You hear me? That's right. But if anybody else has any more information about this, I'd like to continue to follow this story. Hit me up at The Imbiber on Twitter and Instagram, and we'll keep going. We'll stay on this. I won't rest until I find out once and for all that every single customer or knocking point is satisfied. Oh boy. And you know, I'm excited. I'm going to get some Thai food tonight. I love Thai food. I'm getting Thai food delivered. It's one of my favorite cuisines. And I did a little dig in. It turns out three years ago this week, on my former podcast that I did with Emma Patterson called Drinky Fun Time, we had famed celebrity chef Jet Tila was on the show talking about Thai food. And he was telling us about the best places to go in LA. And I want to just play a little snippet because I feel like it's aspirational, you know, that we're going to be able to go again. And I know this is coming. And when that time comes, this is what Jet Tila has to say about Thai places in Los Angeles.
So he wanted to see the first established Thai town in the country. And it's six blocks on Hollywood Boulevard between Western and Normandy where you get the best Thai food in America. And that's what he was really kind of enamored with or amazed by. I mean, America, I think, as a country, like New York has fine dining. It has a lot of big history of cuisine. But if we are talking about global influence cuisine, if we're talking about ethnic cuisine, the West Coast is where it's at. So that's what we have here, I think, on this coast.
Jet, let me ask you this. Somebody's coming in for one night only.
Oof.
They want to have the best Thai food. Where are you sending them? Where do we go?
You're getting me in trouble, bro. You know you're
give us three.
I'll give you three. Give me three, and I'm still gonna get my
All
butt
right.
chewed out.
Give us three.
Yeah, what are the rules here? What I can say?
Whatever
you want.
I can say ass. I can say I'm gonna get my ass kicked by like every other Thai family in LA. Thank you very much. But okay, gun to my head. Northern Thai food, you're going to go to a place called Spicy Thai Barbecue. It's on Santa Monica and Normandy. Southern Thai food, you're going to go to Chiladas.
Okay.
Like world famous. And then you're going to go to a restaurant called Yai, Y-A-I. It's a little strip mall next to 7-Eleven. Bobby Flay and I have a standing mandate every season when he's shooting Food Network star at Yai's restaurant. So you might see us there.
So. That's awesome.
So what the difference between Northern Thai and Southern Thai cuisine.
Yeah, you know, it's not that different. I mean, you can kind of compare it to American cuisine because, you know, in Northern Thailand is all dense forest, a lot of animals, right? So we eat a lot of livestock, et cetera, pork, beef, et cetera. The south of Thailand, as you think about like the movies, like The Beach or The Adam and Sea, Phuket, et cetera.
Yeah.
So seafood. The center, we've got this big thing called the Mekong River that runs all the way through. So we have a lot of freshwater fish. So
wow.
We have four culinary regions. They're all completely unique. They're all amazing. But that's the kind of the easy way to differentiate the four, the eating areas of Thailand.
Jet Tila, good man. Great chef. Great man. Great chef. Give him great across the board. A little later in the show, I'm going to be addressing some comments and questions I've gotten on social media from everybody. But right now, I want to get to our guest. So let's do that. My guest has spent two decades studying the world with a camera. He has documented remote expeditions from Everest to Antarctica, and his photojournalism has appeared in many prestigious high-profile publications, including National Geographic and Smithsonian. His latest project is a fantastic feature-length documentary called Into the Grand Canyon, which is airing now on the National Geographic channel, and I couldn't recommend it higher. Please welcome to the show my old pal, Pete McBride.
Thanks, Dan. Good to see you, buddy.
Good to see you, man. I wish it was in person, but, you know, we can't always get what you want. I want to jump right in and talk about this movie. I saw an article that popped up and I saw this looks interesting and I didn't know it was yours. And then I did some reading and I watched it and it was gorgeous. So tell us about this film.
So the film is, it started out as a magazine story. And the concept was to look at our public lands and our national parks in a different way. And I had this idea. I'd been reading this book about a guy who'd walked the length of the Grand Canyon back in 1960. And I was like, well, hell, why don't I just walk it, follow this guy's, you know, footsteps, so to speak. And just to put it, you know, there's trails all over the world. You know, there's the Pacific Crest Trail. There's the Appalachian Trail. You can hike in the Grand Canyon. There is no trail from end to end. So what ended up being kind of what seemed like a really cool romantic idea ended up being a real slog. But the hiking, really, as hard as it was really just a backbone to look at this place and how lucky we are to have it and how we're passing it forward to the next generation. Are we keeping it as it is as a national park? Or are we kind of slowly changing it and tweaking it and adding more whistles and bells and making it less wild? And so the film is really, it's a slog with a buddy, a dear friend named Kevin Fidarco, 800 miles without a trail, up and down, roughly 100,000 vertical feet, through the course of a year, and looking at different development pressures in this place, looking at native tribes and resource extraction, that kind of stuff.
When you say the course of a year, so initially you had an ambitious plan. You were just going in and you guys are going to hike this thing straight through. There was a guide, somebody you knew who's, I guess, the leading expert on hiking through the Grand Canyon. And he was instructing and helping you out. You guys went in balls to the wall. Here we go. And it wasn't long before your feet were thrashed, your bodies were thrashed, and you had to pull out of there, right? And rethink the whole plan again. Tell us a little bit about that.
So this guy, Rich Rudeau, he's hiked more than anybody that's alive right now that in the Grand Canyon. He's pioneered new routes and figured out these secret slot canyons. And I heard he was going to do a through hike without stopping. And I talked to him and he's like, well, you could come with us for a section. And I was like, great. And being a photographer and a filmmaker, I brought a bunch of my cameras and lenses, as you know, I didn't have a crew. And he looked at me and said, you got too much weight. And he looked at Kevin, my buddy, the writer. He's like, you guys have too much weight. We're like, oh no, we've traveled around the world. We got this. And in literally 5 days, we were so smacked down. My feet looked like hamburger, covered in scrapes and cactus. And then I actually got really sick. I got my electrolyte imbalance so severe, I was basically going unconscious. It's this case called, it's the opposite of dehydration. It's called hyponatremia. And you get your body salt, internal body salt, so low that you basically can slip into coma, unconscious coma and dead in that order pretty quickly.
Jesus Christ, man. What was that feeling like? This was out in the canyon you were getting this?
Yeah, I just suddenly got weaker and weaker. It was extremely hot when we started, one of these, you know, heat waves, more common now that we're seeing. But it was 112 degrees. I don't do well if I have to hike 100 yards in that temperature. But I'm carrying 60 pounds and I'm trying to film. And I just started getting weaker and weaker, and then I started losing my vision, and I kept thinking I was dehydrated because I wasn't peeing. So I kept drinking more water and exacerbating. I was drinking salt too and electrolytes, but I just was way behind. And it's actually the leading cause of death in the Grand Canyon. It happens to guides, rafting guides, you know, tourists, everybody.
I would think falling would be the leading cause of death.
Falling is up there, but this actually happens to a lot of people that are down there all the time.
Taking selfies and plummeting to your fucking death. This is a conversation that I had with a friend earlier, and this very thing came up because I said, when history's written long after you and I are gone, I think humankind's inability or learning to figure out how to adjust to the internet is going to be the single most influential factor on how this era of history was written, because I think so many of the bad things that happened. So for instance, we're having wildfires here in California, but hey, they're having a boy. Like, that's what happened. They did a gender reveal because they want to put it on fucking social media, right? And like, yeah, all these things. And you hear about these people that are dying because, you know what, if I can just get a little closer to the edge of the Grand Canyon, I'm going to get that picture where you can see the water 4,000 feet below me. If I just move out a little bit, I think that's going to play a big role. Is like, human beings, it's like they have this toy that they can't handle. It's like giving a Ferrari and a case of beer and the keys to the Ferrari to a teenage boy and going, go get him. You know what I mean? Like, go find a, you know, and put him on Independence Pass, one of the most windy roads. Go see what you can do, kid. And that's kind of how it is. You know, people are equipped with these cameras and the internet and they're literally making decisions that are killing themselves and others.
And honestly, that was part of the, you know, big discussion of this whole project. You know, did we want to go in and reveal this place with cameras? But, you know, that's part of the balance too, is, you know, there's stupidity. There's the, you know, the Darwin Awards happening on the rim. But we're trying to also show that, is this place more than just an amusement park? That's just, is this place more than a backdrop to your social media, your Instagram? And I would argue it is. And that's why we went on this, you know, what became an epic journey. But the film highlights why this place is more than that. It's not an amusement park. We got plenty of those. It's about, you know, understanding the world around us, the natural world around us. It's actually pretty cool if you get a lift your gaze up from the screen for 2 seconds, which I get it is hard during COVID. But
one of the things that you handle really well in the film, all of it's well, but you handle it all well in the film. But one of the things that you address is certainly this thing that's been going on for a long time. I used to live in Arizona, is the efforts to try to develop in the Grand Canyon, to try to make money off the Grand Canyon, to try to, you know, to tourism. And there was a, I don't want to give away what happens in the movie, but there was a, they wanted to build a tram in one of the most beautiful and also sacred to the Native Americans areas of the Grand Canyon. And the people that want to do that, that want to exploit the Grand Canyon, how they try to sell it. First of all, they try to sell it. It's really sickening to me, to these communities that for reasons that are not their own fault, don't have any money and have been starved. So it's like, hey, we'll dangle this carrot here. We're going to give you a little bit of money. And all you got to do is, you know, sell off your sacred land to us. But, and then they try to present it as though human beings have a right to go everywhere. And that makes me nuts, because as we say, oh, most people don't have the physical ability to hike down into the Grand Canyon. Well, guess what? Good. You know, like what most people can't do everything. Yeah, no shit. Like, and there's a reason for that, you know? So yeah. If you make everything accessible to everybody, then everything gets ruined. You know, it's amazing to me. And that's, and I won't give away what happens in the movie, but you certainly put a focus on the greed heads that are, you know, the helicopter thing. I've been to the Grand Canyon, and the helicopter thing is really, really sad, and it makes me angry. You can't enjoy yourself. The serenity and the beauty of the place is just ruined. What is that area, Pete, where they allow the helicopters?
That's Western Grand Canyon, and it's now called Heli Alley. Like, we took a section, and now we've renamed it. And, you know, I love helicopters. I mean, they're great tools and for transport, for filming, for what I do, but there's, you know, there has to be a balance somewhere. Like you said, we cannot figure out a balance in these things. We're really good at trashing places.
Absolutely.
And, these parks are some of the last places we have, you know, that aren't totally trashed. They're heading that way, sadly, a lot of them, but, you know, I think that's what we need to kind of use them as. Maybe now that with COVID, people realize we need places like this because we're so cooped up at home. We got to go and have places actually chill out and be quiet and get away from our screens and our toys and our beeps and all that jazz. But
I think there's definitely going to be a new appreciation. I know me personally, I've made a few little road trips in this area. And that's one of the beauties of living in California is that there's so much, you know, that you go 2 hours this way and you're in the desert, you go 2 hours this way, you're in the mountains, and you go for me to 5 minutes this way and I'm at the ocean. I've taken these trips, and I got to tell you, I've been moved to tears. I went out to the high desert last week near Joshua Tree and moved to tears and things that I've done before that I took for granted. I suddenly go, oh man, I'm never going to take this stuff for granted again. The next time I can go sit in a restaurant, by the way, in a nice restaurant and have a nice meal with a bunch of people and get up and walk to the bar and pat somebody on the back, that's going to be special too. But the nature part of it is something I think there's going to be a new value placed on that.
Yeah. And you can now go 2 minutes and you can be in a wildfire, like I can here too. Everything's burning here. So, but yeah, I think that's hopefully we'll be reminded of, you know, how it's important and that we can't turn, you know, just because it's beautiful, there's this notion we want to turn beauty into cash wherever we can. And that's what kind of the film was kind of, we're trying to highlight that. And because we're not aware of it. And, you know, I'm not trying to bang up on everybody in the film and helicopters. I get people need to make money, especially these native tribes. That's where these helicopters land. And the the Wallapai tribal community, and they don't have any other way to make income. So I get it, but we need to have certain regulations so we don't just totally love these places to death.
Absolutely. And, but to what you were saying a little bit earlier, I had a conversation once with a friend who knew Anthony Bourdain. No one could know except Anthony Bourdain, and he's gone. But my friend's theory, beyond, you know, what have possible medications and things, but why someone, you know, that was always the question, like, why would a guy like Anthony Bourdain take his own life, right? My friend's theory was that he was most celebrated for, and the thing that everybody pointed out was what made his life so amazing, was he got to go and see all these places and meet all these people and do all, and go to the most remote areas of the world, something that you do, and I want to get your perspective on this. And my friend said that what he thought was happening was Bourdain was also got to witness how so many of these things were being ruined and exploited, and how money and the pursuit of and greed was starving these people, and a lot of things were getting ruined. And I know that's maybe a bleak way, but that was one of the things that really depressed him, that made him sad. The fact that he got to see the world and maybe didn't like what he saw altogether. Now, you've been doing this a long time. Do you notice a change from when you first started traveling the world and going to all these remote places to now? And again, the internet. And by the way, just to say, I also say that has so much to do with the internet, because I remember when you and I first knew each other in Aspen back in the 90s, you know, the internet barely existed. And the only way I would hear about these places were from people like you. Like, oh man, we went to Costa Rica, we went there. Now everybody has access to every place, one click, and they go, oh, I'm going to go there. And that there's a good part to that, but there's also a real downside to that, right?
Yeah, it's double-edged. We didn't even have cell phones then when I knew you.
No, man.
I had to wait for you on the block, man.
Yeah, and it was great. I don't feel like I missed out, really. You know, I was like, where's everyone?
I think it was maybe richer, but yeah, I've seen the world change in front of my eyes, and it's partly what I do now is I focus a lot of things on fresh water. So just an example, before I did the Grand Canyon Project, the reason I did it is that I did a project where I followed the Colorado River from its source to the sea. But the river doesn't reach the sea anymore, and I didn't even know that. And I grew up on the river, and I was like, wow, this, how do people know more about, you know, Justin Bieber than they do about where their water comes from?
Because they're leaching the water in like Phoenix and places like that.
Yeah, we've got too many straws, and we're sucking it dry, and we killed this amazing estuary. And so I was invited to the Grand Canyon to give a talk about what happened to the river. So I'd seen a river that I grew up with disappear. Then I go to the Grand Canyon and I figure, well, this is a national park, you know, I'll give a talk about the river, but the park's protected. And when I was there, everybody's like, no, you have no idea what's going on here. They're doing this. There's a tram, there's mining, there's helicopters, there's a huge, you know, water ski park they want to build, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, really?
It's so making my blood boil as you're saying it.
But one interesting thing is, you know, back to the beginning of the trip where we got our asses handed to us is, that would the great lesson in that, which I think the Grand Canyon and a lot of these wild places teach us, is humility. And it, you know, we are not in control of the planet. We're not, and we need to be give these places respect. I mean, the Grand Canyon will beat you down so quickly if you don't respect it. And it's not, you know, just a one click spot you go. And I think the good side is you give it respect and you go, you don't need to go to the bottom. You can have just as much of an impact from it by just sitting on the darn rim in quiet and being like, wow, I'm actually a little smaller than I thought I was, in a good way, not in like a depressing way. Makes you think about that, you know, there's bigger things out there than us and our little orbits that we think is so important in our social media, etc.
Amen.
So those, I think our parks and these places like that, they don't have to be the Grand Canyon. They can be your backyard, frankly, have value in being untouched. Hopefully we can try to keep doing that. But
this is a show called What We're Drinking, so I should probably undepress my listeners at this point. Let me ask you about, so first of all, I guess when you're doing a trip like that, do you ever have anything to drink when you're on that trip? Is it, you know, is there any sort of maybe a bottle of champagne, something to celebrate, or no?
Totally.
Oh, you did. When you were in the Grand Canyon, you had wine?
So we hiked 800 miles, roughly 15 to 16 miles a day with a heavy pack. the whole time you're thinking about what your next drink is going to be, mainly water, because you're drinking, you're thirsty the whole time. And so you're, or, and you're drinking, you know, mucky water. But then we cache our food in these buckets, and we have friends that left them, and they GPS tag it and take pictures, and the GPS didn't work, so we could find our buckets of food, mostly freeze-dried crap and almonds. I basically lived on almonds and mangoes, dried mangoes. But our buddy that did it, on every food cache, he would leave a bottle of booze. And tequila or some like relatively, you know, cheap red wine. And when you arrive starving, thirsty, and you come to the bottom of your food cache bucket after like 12 days of walking 15 miles a day, and you come to a bottle of wine or tequila, it's really hard to figure out how to, like, you know, parse it out. Plus, you don't want to carry it because it's heavy. So,
and how are those hikes the next day after you polished off a bottle of tequila? And now it's 102 in the Grand Canyon.
Yeah, and then you're just crushed, and you're further, you know, down the path of getting sick and not moving. But it was a treat. So we didn't do it every time, but I guarantee you that we had some well earned cocktails.
Nice. And I should point out to everybody that the thing that really struck me the most about the movie, beyond the activism and Pete telling the story of what's going on, is the sheer beauty. I mean, it's such a beautiful film, and your reputation as a photographer precedes you, but it looks so good. And then also, it freaked me the hell out. I called you, I was texting with you. I think we were on the phone and we talked about it. And I said, man, I was getting so nervous because you were so close to the edge. And it was a very similar feeling I had to when I watched Free Solo, the movie about Alex Honnold climbing El Capitan. I knew he made it. I saw him at the Oscars after they did it. I knew he was alive. But yet when I was watching that movie, I was, again, moving me to tears and making me very, very uncomfortable. And I'm saying, no, Jesus, don't. And that was happening in your film as well. And I was pretty sure you were still alive too. Does it freak you out when you're up there? I mean, you were walking. What's the highest point you were walking right on the edge? How high up?
There's a couple sections where we walked probably on an edge with 3,000 vertical feet. So basically the equivalent of what Alex climbed was dropping below us. Maybe, you know, there were some shelves in it. So maybe it was, if you fell, you'd probably go clean 1,000 feet and then bounce and do another couple.
And you were one stumble away from that. I mean, you're walking right on the edge, right? If you've got some loose rock.
It looks crazy, but what's interesting is the edge is where all the rocks fall off. So it's like a sidewalk, and it's flat. You go up from the edge a little bit, and it's 45 degrees with marbles on it. And so when you're up on that, you're further away from the edge, but you feel like you're going to kick out and do the bounce and slip off the edge. So if you just walk right on the edge and don't let your mind play tricks on you, it's actually easier and safer in a really weird logic. But you just get comfortable the more you're out there, the more you're doing it. And at times maybe too comfortable, but you get really in tune with your body and your surroundings.
Well, the obvious dangers, which we talked about that one, and then we also talked about the extreme weather conditions and the things it can do to your body. Do you have to worry about wildlife out there, snakes and things like that? Is that a real possible danger?
Snakes are a concern, but we did a lot of it in the colder temperatures, and they're pretty dormant, and they're frankly not out to hurt you. If you step on them, they'll defend themselves and you can get bitten, and that'd be bad. Scorpions, you look for scorpions. You don't want to get stung by a scorpion.
Oh, I got bit when I lived in Arizona. Oh, so, man, you know. Not fun. I got stung by a scorpion in bed.
Yeah, that's where they get you.
I felt like I was having a dream that my upper body was on fire. And then I woke up. As soon as I woke up, it felt like someone had gotten me with a hot cattle prod in my shoulder. It was where it got me, on the shoulder.
Is that what that pad is?
Yeah, exactly. No, that's know what that is? Know where I got this? We're talking about a tattoo on my shoulder. This is, don't get fucked up with your cousin, Dennis McGlynn, you know, my cousin, and go to see Calamity Jane. I think it was in Carbondale, Colorado, way back in the Aspen days. It was the very first tattoo I ever got. People go, what is it? I go, I don't know. I think I was on mushrooms. And I was like, just put that thing on my arm for the rest of my life. It's a circle. If anybody can see this, tell me what it is.
Cool. It looks kind of like a scorpion winding its way around your shoulder.
No, so I got the Hunter Thompson tattoo. I got the Clash right here. But this one, I don't know what it is. But anyway, I woke up and I must have swatted and I turned the light on and I just grabbed my arm immediately. I was like, what? And then I looked down on the floor and I saw this thing on the floor. And it wasn't a big guy. So it turns out it was what's called a bark scorpion. And they're mm-hmm. the smaller ones, but they hurt you more, okay?
But they hurt.
So I went and got a piece of Tupperware and put it over top of this thing. And then it was hurting so bad that I went to the hospital and I took the scorpion with me. And they said, yeah, it was bark scorpion. He bit you. And they gave me, I think they might have given me an anti-venom or something like that. But my arm for about 2 weeks, like it felt like I had taken a punch to the shoulder from Mike Tyson in his prime. It was swollen and it really hurt. So I can't imagine getting bitten in the Grand Canyon and having the hike on.
Yeah, that didn't happen, thankfully. A buddy of mine got bit by a mouse.
A mouse?
Yeah, there's mice.
Mice bite you?
Well, they're looking for food. And they run over your face. It's horrible.
Oh.
That's probably the worst thing. We follow sheep, vultures. We follow mountain lion. But we never saw the mountain lion, but we follow the tracks. They're the stealthy guide.
But they don't want to come for you either, right?
No, no. So there's really nothing out there to get you. I mean, really, the cactus was just like nemesis.
They call it the jumping cactus, too.
Jumping cactus, beaver tail. There's so many cactus. And every time you get tired, you take your gaze down and you step into a cactus and you're just like, ow! And then you get them buried in your skin. I had to have some surgically removed. I came out.
Wow, that sounds so painful, man.
A doc. I have a buddy who's a doc, and he's like, well, I think you got needles in there. I'm going to go fishing. So he just deadened up my ankle with me watching and cut in there and was like, oh, yeah, here's one.
Oh, God, Pete, that sounds terrible. Did you – I was wondering this as I was watching the movie because you are out – my brain goes to weird places. And so the beauty and all that's there. But then I'm also like, oh my God, if like a serial killer psycho guy happened to be there, you're in the middle of nowhere. Do you carry anything like any sort of a weapon in case a mountain lion or a human being or you?
No, we didn't. But the funny story is, so we're out in Western Grand Canyon in this section that's really remote. Nobody goes to. And, it's brutal. And Kevin we're having a terrible day. It's hotter than hell and we're not finding water and we're sort of grouchy. And we come along this trail and here comes an ATV. The first time we'd ever seen anybody on the whole time, except outside of like the main tourist area. This guy's coming for us. And we stopped and looked at each other like, should we be worried? Like, is this going to be weird? And the guy was kind of had the same thing and he was tentative. And then finally we meet and say hi and it was fine. And he's like, man, I thought you guys might've been survivors of a plane crash.
Because that's how remote it is out there.
Yeah. He couldn't figure out how we got there and what we're doing on foot. And we look like shit.
And so people understand you're so far out that if something happened to you, if you broke your ankle, stepped on you're in serious trouble out there, right? I mean, you do have a satellite phone and all that, but
didn't have a sat phone. We had a satellite text device, but the park service is not going to come swoop you up when you get injured. You're on your own. They might come get your body when you don't report in after, a day or two.
Really? I would have thought most people would believe that that's what they know. That's your own risk out there.
They do, but where we were in a lot of places, it's so remote and so hard to get to, but if you get injured, getting a helicopter rescue is pretty unlikely. It's feasible in certain areas, but not everywhere.
So you all know we are talking about Into the Grand Canyon. It's Pete McBride's movie. It's available on National Geographic Channel. You can get that through your Disney Plus, or if you still have cable, if you haven't cut the cord yet and you have the Nat Geo channel, I couldn't recommend it more. You're actually up possibly for an Emmy nomination, right? You're going to find out soon.
Yeah, September 22nd. We're up against David Attenborough.
That guy.
I know,
he's
won two.
Didn't he just die, though? Didn't he just die?
I don't think so.
Oh, I thought he did.
Did somebody
die?
Oh, well, I'm sure.
Now I got to look this up. Hold on a second here, Dave. I'm putting him in the grave here. David Attenborough, let's see. He is... He is. That's the first thing you do when you go to Wikipedia. It just says the name, and then it either says is or was. And he's 94 years old. He's not dead. I'm sorry, David Attenborough. I'm sorry, David Attenborough fans are like, what? Still alive.
He's a legend. So we're up against a very expensive TV series that he did, and another few films. Some friends of mine that made some films. So it's fun to have my friends in the process. But my one time to get invited to a red carpet party, I will be in my living room watching it on Zoom
because of COVID. Damn it.
Yeah. So.
One other question for you before I let you go here, Pete. So you've been all around the world. I mean, to some of the most far-flung places on this planet. What's some of the weirdest stuff you've drank?
Outside of Grand Canyon, where I had to squeeze water out of cow manure.
I'm talking about adult beverages here.
I had the weirdest drink? That probably was an adult beverage because it had petrified so much. But weirdest drink, I had a camel milk with rum.
Oh, how was that?
It wasn't good.
Not good. What is camel? What, I didn't even know camels could be milked.
Yeah, oily.
Oily. Not a quality I look for in my cocktails, you know? Can you put a little extra oil in there, huh? Drop a little. Can you put some Wesson? I'd like a gin and tonic with a little Wesson in there. Yeah, just some Wesson. Put it in.
This is like gear oil.
Well, you've been to the Dominican Republic?
I haven't.
Oh, so I've been there several times. It's stuff like they have a thing called Mama Juana, which is a rum, and they steep it with every herb and thing they can find, and they just stuff it all in the bottle, and there's twigs and everything else in there. And I'm going to actually have a Pitbull, the artist Pitbull singer, is going to be on my show soon, and he is going to start importing Mama Juana to the United States. So that's
really,
it's not going to be the same Mama Juana that you get in Santo Domingo or something like that. I mean, the thing about Dominican Republic is they have all the beach communities, the resort communities, but I've been into the cities and things like that. And that's where you get, someone will pour you a glass and you think, well, where's this been? Well, hopefully the distillation will have taken care of whatever's.
Have you been to Peru?
I have not been to Peru. No.
So up in the Himalaya, they make a beer, which they basically chew the corn and then spit it in to this big tub, and that saliva activates the corn to start the process to turn it into a brew. So you're drinking like a corn spit brew, which it's pretty good actually.
But you nose like, that and you go, well, I'm getting bad breath here. Yeah. I think what are you getting on the nose here? It's a little plaque.
I'm getting a little coffee breath.
Dental plaque, I think, in there. Yeah. Because, you know, they're not brushing their teeth in Peru that often, that much.
Not that often.
You know, they got
some... But it does its job.
Well, Pete, I really appreciate you joining. You mentioned before we got on the air that you're actually headed back to the Grand Canyon tomorrow.
I am. I'm actually going to meet some friends down there and go kayak the upper section, which will be a good way to go isolate. And
how long is that trip going to take?
That's 7 days, and I won't be carrying my life on my back, and might actually have a few more adult beverages available than every just food cache. So it'll be nice.
Yeah. Those rafts can carry a case of beer. No problem.
I've heard they can carry a case or two.
What do I have exciting going up in the adventure world?
You're going to get Pitbull to teach you some merengue or you know, reggaeton or something?
That guy's got a limitless supply of energy. I've watched some of his videos. Man, he goes for it, Pitbull.
Yeah,
I wish you the best, man. I really hope that you get this Emmy nomination. It's a movie I recommend to everybody. Check it out. Into the Grand Canyon, Nat Geo channel. Oh, Pete, where can people find to look at some of your work, your photography? You on the social medias?
I'm an Instagram guy, so Pedro McBride.
Pedro McBride. For those of you who don't know, Pedro is Spanish for Pete. His name's Pete.
So. Yeah,
see? Got that. Pete McBride, everybody.
He was taken, so we went with
Pete McBride, everybody. Great seeing you, man.
Great to see you. Thanks.
Folks, I've never admitted this on the show before, but I'm a guy. Yeah, it's true. And as a guy, I'm here to tell you that so much of our identity is wrapped up in our hair. That's why when we get into our 20s and 30s and start noticing the first signs of hair loss, it definitely feels like panic time. Because let's face it, no guy is ever ready to go bald. Thankfully, now there's Keeps, a simple and easy way to keep your hair. You can visit a doctor online and get hair loss medication delivered right to your home. So you can say goodbye to pharmacy checkout lines and awkward doctor visits. Keeps treatments typically take between 4 to 6 months to see results, so it's important to act fast. The sooner you start using Keeps, the more hair you'll save. Treatments start at just $10 per month. Plus, for a limited time, you can get your first month free. That's right, free. How? Well, if you're ready to take action to prevent hair loss, go to keeps.com/drinking. That's KEEPS.com/drinking to receive your first month of treatment for free. Take care of your hair, and your hair will take care of you. You got to keep the hair. You got to keep it. You lose it, you lose more than just something to keep your head warm. It's pride and all that other stuff. Anyway, as threatened at the top of the show, I wanted to get to some questions that people have posed on the social medias, because it's important to me to engage and to keep you informed and to be there for you. I want to be there for you. You got questions? I'm here at The Imbiber, Twitter, Instagram, anytime, night or day, reach out. Sarah T on Twitter wrote and asked, oh, she didn't ask, she just wrote and said, I love the show. Wish you had a few more female guests. And Sarah, I wholeheartedly agree. I wish I had more female guests as well, because I like females, first and foremost. But the thing is, this business, sadly, is still predominantly male. Although women have made tremendous progress in the industry, and it's getting better and better week in and week out. But the celebrity portion of it as well, and that's what drives this show a lot, are celebrities that are in the adult beverage game, and most of them are male still. But we do have Christy Brinkley coming on the show soon. She's got a sparkling wine. She's going to be on here, Bellissima. And we're working on getting Cameron Diaz, who's also got a wine. So bear with me, Sarah T. I'm trying. We got Elias. What is it? Elias OK3 on Instagram writes, football season is here. I'll be drinking all day every Sunday. Can you offer any tips for preventing hangovers? No, Elias, I can't, because I don't try to prevent hangovers. I simply accept the pain. Such masochism, no doubt connected to being a lifelong Philly sports fan. Okay, fine. Maybe start with not drinking all day Sunday, Elias. Try holding off till, noon. Valerie D74 on Twitter asks, if you were stranded on a deserted island, you can only have one bottle of alcohol, what would it be and why? A deserted island? Well, that's easy. I'd go with a nice dessert wine. Robert Green on Facebook asks, what's in a Long Island iced tea? Well, Robert, I'd say a future hangover. Somebody hose me down, please. I am on fire today. And finally, BWG222. So interesting. It's a mouthful. BWG222 on Instagram asked, people say you shouldn't mix hard liquor and beer. What do you think? Well, BWG, people say lots of stupid things. And I've found that nothing drowns out the meaningless drivel quite like a few stiff Boilermakers. In fact, your message just got me inspired. So I'm out of here, okay? Thank you for joining me. Thank you, Pete McBride. Check out Pete's movie, Into the Grand Canyon, on Nat Geo. And I'll catch you on the next episode.